This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents The Atlantis Gene. Written by A.G. Riddle. Narrated by Stephen Bell Davies. Prologue. Research vessel Icefall. Atlantic Ocean. 88 miles off the coast of Antarctica. Carl Selig steadied himself on the ship's rail and peered through the binoculars at the massive iceberg. Near the center of the iceberg, another piece of ice crumbled and fell away, revealing more of the long black object it had covered. It looked almost like a submarine, but it couldn't be. "Hey, Steve, come check this out." Steve Cooper, Carl's grad school friend, tied off a buoy and joined Carl on the other side of the boat. He took the binoculars, scanned quickly, then stopped.
"Whoa. What is it? A sub?"
"Maybe. What's under it?" Carl grabbed the binoculars. "Under it?" He panned to the area under the sub. There was something else. The sub, if it was a sub, was sticking out of another metallic object, this one gray and much, much larger than the sub. But unlike the sub, the gray object didn't reflect any light. It looked more like waves, the kind that shimmer just over the horizon of a warm highway or a long stretch of desert. It wasn't warm, though, or at least it wasn't melting the ice around it. Just above the structure, Carl caught a glimpse of some writing on the sub. U-977 and SS Kriegsmarine. A Nazi sub. Sticking out of a structure of some sort. Carl dropped the binoculars to his side. "Wake Naomi up and prepare to dock the boat. We're going to check it out." Steve rushed below deck, and Carl heard him rousing Naomi from one of the small boat's two cabins. Carl's corporate sponsor had insisted he take Naomi along. Carl had nodded in the meeting and hoped she wouldn't get in the way. He had not been disappointed. When they had put to sea 5 weeks ago in Cape Town, South Africa, Naomi had brought aboard two changes of clothes, three romance novels, and enough vodka to kill a Russian army. They had barely seen her since. It must be so boring for her out here, Carl thought. For him, it was the opportunity of a lifetime. Carl raised the binoculars and looked again at the massive piece of ice that had broken off from Antarctica nearly a month ago. Almost 90% of the iceberg was underwater, but the surface area still covered 47 square miles, 1.5 times the size of Manhattan. Carl's doctoral thesis focused on how newly halved icebergs affected global sea currents as they dissolved. Over the last 4 weeks, he and Steve had deployed high-tech buoys around the iceberg that measured sea temp and saltwater-freshwater balance, as well as took periodic sonar readings of the iceberg's changing shape. The goal was to learn more about how icebergs disintegrated after leaving Antarctica. Antarctica held 90% of the world's ice, and when it melted in the next few centuries, it would dramatically change the world. He hoped his research would shed light on exactly how. Carl had called Steve the minute he found out he was funded. "You've got to come with me." "No, trust me." Steve had reluctantly agreed, and to Carl's delight, his old friend had come alive on the expedition as they took readings by day and discussed the preliminary findings each night. Before the voyage, Steve's academic career had been as listless as the iceberg they were following, as he floated from one thesis topic to another. Carl and their other friends had wondered if he would drop out of the doctoral program altogether. The research readings had been intriguing, and now they had found something else. Something remarkable. There would be headlines, but what would they say? Nazi sub found in Antarctica? It wasn't inconceivable. Carl knew the Nazis had been obsessed with Antarctica. They'd sent expeditions there in 1938 and 1939, and even claimed part of the continent as a new German province, Neuschwabenland. Several Nazi subs were never recovered during World War II and were not known to have been sunk. The conspiracy theorists claimed that a Nazi sub left Germany just before the fall of the Third Reich, carrying away the highest-ranking Nazis and the entire treasury, including priceless artifacts that had been looted and top-secret technology. The conspiracies grew grander with each passing year, but there it was, a Nazi sub in an iceberg off the coast of Antarctica. At the back of Carl's mind, a new thought emerged. Reward money. If there was Nazi treasure on the sub, it would be worth a huge amount of money. He would never have to worry about research funding again. The immediate challenge was docking the boat to the iceberg. The seas were rough, and it took them 3 passes, but they finally managed to tie off a few miles from the sub and the strange structure under it. Carl and Steve bundled up tight and donned their climbing gear. Carl gave Naomi some basic instructions, the long and short of which were, "Don't touch anything." And then he and Steve lowered themselves to the ice shelf below the boat and set off. For the next 45 minutes, neither man said anything as they trudged across the barren ice mountain. The ice was rougher toward the interior, and their pace slowed. Steve's more than Carl's. "We need to pick it up, Steve." Steve made an effort to catch up. "Sorry, a month on the boat has got me out of shape." Carl glanced up at the sun. When it set, the temperature would plummet, and they would likely freeze to death. The days were long here. The sun rose at 2:30 a.m. and set after 10 p.m., but they only had a few more hours. Carl picked up his pace a little more. Behind him, he heard Steve shuffling his snowshoes as fast as he could, trying desperately to catch up. Strange sounds echoed from the ice. First a low drone, then a rapid hammering, like 1,000 woodpeckers assaulting the ice. Carl stopped and listened. He turned to Steve, and their eyes met just as a spider web of tiny cracks shot out across the ice below Steve's feet. Steve looked down in horror, and then ran as hard as he could toward Carl and the untouched ice. For Carl, the scene was surreal, unfolding almost in slow motion. He felt himself run toward his friend and throw a rope from his belt. Steve caught the rope a split second before a loud crack filled the air, and the ice below him collapsed, forming a giant chasm. The rope instantly pulled tight, jerking Carl off his feet and slamming him belly first into the ice. He was going to follow Steve into the ice canyon. Carl scrambled to get his feet under him, but the tug of the rope was too strong. He relaxed his hands, and the rope slid through them, slowing his forward motion. He planted his feet in front of him, and the crampons beneath his boots bit into the ice, sending shards of ice at his face as he came to a halt. He squeezed the rope and pulled tight against the ledge, making a strange, vibrating sound almost like a low violin. "Steve, hang on! I'm going to pull you up!"
"Don't!"
Steve yelled.
"What? Are you crazy? There's something down here! Lower me! Slowly!"
Carl thought for a moment.
"What is it?" "Looks like a tunnel or a cave. It's got gray metal in it. It's blurry." "Okay, hold on. I'm going to let some slack out."
Carl let about 10 feet of rope out, and when he heard nothing from Steve, another 10 feet.
"Stop!"
Steve called. Carl felt the rope tugging. Was Steve swinging? The rope went slack.
"I'm in,"
Steve said.
"What is it?" "Not sure."
Steve's voice was muffled now. Carl crawled to the edge of the ice and looked over. Steve stuck his head out of the mouth of the cave.
"I think it's some kind of cathedral. It's massive. There's writings on the walls. Symbols like nothing I've ever seen. I'm going to check it out."
"Steve, don't." Steve disappeared again. A few minutes passed. Was there another slight vibration? Carl listened closely. He couldn't hear it, but he could feel it. The ice was pulsing faster now. He stood up and took a step away from the edge. The ice behind him cracked, and then there were cracks everywhere and spreading quickly. He ran full speed toward the widening fissure. He jumped and almost made it to the other side, but came up short. His hands caught on the ice ledge, and he dangled there for a long second. The vibrations in the ice grew more violent with each passing second. Carl watched the ice around him crumble and fall, and then the shard that had held him broke free, and he was plummeting down into the abyss. On the boat, Naomi watched the sunset over the iceberg. She picked up the satellite phone and dialed the number the man had given her. "You said to call if we found anything interesting."
"Don't say anything. Hold the line. We'll have your location within 2 minutes. We'll come to you."
She set the phone on the counter, walked back to the stove, and continued stirring the pot of beans. The man on the other end of the satellite phone looked up when the GPS coordinates flashed on his screen. He copied the location and searched the satellite surveillance database for live feeds. One result. He opened the stream and panned the view to the center of the iceberg, where the dark spots were. He zoomed in several times, and when the image came into focus, he dropped his coffee to the floor, bolted out of his office, and ran down the hallway to the director's office. He barged in, interrupting a gray-haired man who was standing and speaking with both hands held up. "We found it." Part 1. Jakarta Burning. Chapter 1. Autism Research Center, ARC, Jakarta, Indonesia. Present day. Dr. Kate Warner awoke to a terrifying feeling. There was someone in the room. She tried to open her eyes, but couldn't. She felt groggy, almost as though she had been drugged. The air was musty, subterranean. She twisted slightly, and pain coursed through her. The bed below her was hard. A couch, maybe. Definitely not the bed in her 19th-floor condo in downtown Jakarta. Where am I? She heard another quiet footfall, like tennis shoes on carpet. "Kate," a man whispered, testing to see if she was awake. Kate managed to open her eyes a little. Above her, faint rays of sunlight filtered through metal blinds that covered short, wide windows. In the corner, a strobe light pierced the room every few seconds, like the flash of a camera snapping a photo incessantly. She took a deep breath and sat up quickly, seeing the man for the first time. He reeled back, dropping something that clanged as brown liquid splashed on the floor. It was Ben Adelson, her lab assistant.
"Jesus, Kate, I'm sorry. I thought if you were up, you might want coffee."
He bent to pick up the remnants of a shattered coffee cup, and when he got a closer look at her, he said, "No offense, but you look like hell, Kate." He stared at her for a moment. "Please tell me what's going on." Kate rubbed her eyes, and her head seemed to clear a bit as she realized where she was. She had been working at the lab day and night for the last 5 days, virtually non-stop since she had gotten a call from her research sponsor. Produce results now, any results, or the funding goes away. No excuses this time. She hadn't told any of the staff on her autism study. There was no reason to worry them. Either she got some results and they went on, or she didn't and they went home.
"Coffee sounds nice, Ben. Thanks."
The man exited the van and pulled his black face mask down.
"Use your knife inside. Gunfire will draw attention."
His assistant, a woman, nodded and pulled her face mask down as well. The man extended his gloved hand to the door, but then hesitated.
"You're sure the alarm is off?"
"Yeah. Well, I cut the outside line. But it's probably going off inside." What? He shook his head. Jesus, they could be calling it in right now. Let's be quick. He threw the door open and charged inside. Above the door, a sign read, Autism Research Center. Staff entrance. Ben returned with a fresh cup of coffee, and Kate thanked him. He plopped down in a chair opposite her desk. You're going to work yourself to death. I know you've slept here for the past 4 nights. And the secrecy, banning everyone from the lab, hoarding your notes, not talking about ARC 247. I'm not the only one who's worried. Kate sipped the coffee. Jakarta had been a difficult place to run a clinical trial, but working on the island of Java had some bright spots. The coffee was one of them. She couldn't tell Ben what she was doing in the lab, at least not yet. It might amount to nothing, and more than likely, they were all out of a job anyway. Involving him would only make him an accomplice to a possible crime. Kate nodded to the flashing fixture in the corner of the room. What's that strobe light? Ben glanced over his shoulder at it. Not sure. An alarm, I think. Fire? No, I made the rounds when I got here. It's not a fire. I was about to do a thorough inspection when I noticed that your door was cracked. Ben reached into one of the dozen cardboard boxes that crowded Kate's office. He flipped through a few framed diplomas. Why don't you put these up? I don't see the point. Hanging the diplomas wasn't Kate's style, and even if it were, who would she impress with them? Kate was the only investigator and physician on the study, and all the staff knew her CV. They received no visitors, and the only other people who saw her office were the 2 dozen staff who cared for the autistic children in the study. The staff would think Stanford and Johns Hopkins were people, long-deceased relatives, maybe. The diplomas, perhaps, their birth certificates. I'd put it up if I had an M.D. from Johns Hopkins. Ben carefully placed the diploma back in the box and rummaged around in it some more. Kate drained the last of the coffee. Yeah? She held the cup out. I'll trade you for another cup of coffee. Does this mean I can give you orders now? Don't get carried away, Kate said, as Ben left the room. She stood and twisted the hard plastic cylinder that controlled the blinds, revealing a view of the chain-link fence that circled their building, and beyond it, the crowded streets of Jakarta. The morning commute was in full swing. Buses and cars crept along as motorcycles darted in and out of the tight spaces between them. Bicycles and pedestrians filled every square inch of the sidewalks, and she had thought the traffic in San Francisco was bad. It wasn't just the traffic. Jakarta still felt so foreign to her. It wasn't home. Maybe it never would be. 4 years ago, Kate would have moved anywhere in the world, any place that wasn't San Francisco. Martin Gray, her adoptive father, had said, Jakarta would be a great place to continue your research and to start over. He had also said something about time healing all wounds, but now she was running out of time. She turned back to the desk and began clearing away the photos Ben had taken out. She stopped at a faded picture of a large dancing room with a parquet floor. How had that gotten in with her work things? It was the only photo she had of her childhood home in West Berlin, just off Tiergartenstrasse. Kate could barely picture the massive 3-story residence. In her memory, it felt more like a foreign embassy or a grand estate from another time, a castle, an empty castle. Kate's mother had died during childbirth, and while her father had been loving, he had rarely been present. Kate tried to picture him in her mind's eye, but she couldn't. There was only a vague recollection of a cold day in December when he had taken her for a walk. She remembered how tiny her hand felt inside of his, how safe she felt. They had walked all the way down Tiergartenstrasse to the Berlin Wall. It was a somber scene, families placing wreaths and pictures, hoping and praying for the wall to fall and their loved ones to return. The other memories were flashes of him leaving and returning.
always with some trinket from a faraway place. The house staff had taken up the slack as best they could. They were attentive, but perhaps a little cold. What was the housekeeper's name? Or the tutor who lived with her and the other staff on the top floor? She had taught Kate German. She could still speak German, but she couldn't remember the woman's name. About the only clear memory of the first 6 years of her life was the night Martin came into her dance room, turned the music off, and told her that her father wasn't coming home, ever again, and that she would be coming to live with him. She wished she could erase that memory, and she'd just as soon forget the 13 years that followed. She had moved to America with Martin, but the cities ran together as he rushed off to one expedition after another, and she was shipped off to one boarding school after another. None of them ever felt like home either. Her research lab was the closest thing she had ever had to a real home. She spent every waking moment here. She had thrown herself into her work after San Francisco, and what had started as a defense mechanism, a survival mechanism, had become her routine, her lifestyle. The research team had become her family, and the research participants, her children. And it was all about to go away. She needed to focus. And she needed more coffee. She pushed the pile of photos off the desk and into the box below. Where was Ben? Kate walked out into the hall and made her way to the staff kitchen. Empty. She checked the coffee pot. Empty. The strobe lights were going off here, too. Something was wrong. Ben? Kate called out. The other research staff wouldn't be in for hours. They kept a strange schedule, but they did good work. Kate cared more about the work. She ventured out into the research wing, which consisted of a series of storage rooms and offices surrounding a large clean room lab where Kate and her team engineered gene therapy retroviruses they hoped would cure autism. She peered through the glass. Ben wasn't in the lab. The building was creepy at this time of morning. It was empty, quiet, and not quite dark, but not light either. Shafts of focused sunlight poured into the hallways from the windows in the rooms on each side, like searchlights probing for signs of life. Kate's footfalls echoed loudly as she prowled the cavernous research wing, peeking into each room, squinting to see through the bright Jakartan sun. All empty. That left the residential section, the housing units, kitchens, and supporting facilities for the study's roughly 100 autistic children. In the distance, Kate could hear other footsteps, faster than hers, running. She began walking more quickly, in their direction, and just as she turned the corner, Ben reached out and grabbed her arm. "Kate, follow me! Hurry!" Chapter 2. Manggarai Train Station, Jakarta, Indonesia. David Vale stepped back into the shadow of the train station's ticket counter. He studied the man buying a New York Times from the newsstand. The man paid the vendor, then walked past the trash can without throwing the paper away. Not the contact. Behind the newsstand, a commuter train crept into the station. It was packed to the walls with Indonesian workers coming into the capital from the outlying cities for the day's work. Passengers hung out of every set of sliding double doors, middle-aged men mostly. On the roof of the train, teenagers and young adults sat, squatted, and stretched out, reading newspapers, fiddling with smartphones, and talking. The crowded commuter train was a symbol of Jakarta itself, a city bursting at the seams with a growing population struggling to modernize. Mass transit was only the most visible sign of the city's struggle to accommodate the 28 million people in its metro area. The commuters were fleeing the train now, swarming the station like shoppers on Black Friday in America. It was chaos. Workers pushed, shoved, and shouted as they ran out of the station's doors, while others fought to get into the station. This happened here and in other commuter train stations throughout the city every day. It was the perfect place for a meet. David kept his eyes focused on the newsstand. His earpiece crackled to life. Collector, watch up. Be advised, we're at 0 hour plus 20. The contact was late. The team was growing nervous. The unspoken question was, do we abort? David raised his mobile phone to his face. Copy, watch shop, trader, broker, report. From his vantage point, David could see the two other operatives. One sat on a bench in the middle of the bustling crowd. The other man was working on a light near the restrooms. Both reported no sign of their anonymous informant, a man who claimed to have details of an imminent terrorist attack called Toba Protocol. The operatives were good, two of Jakarta Station's best. David could barely pick them out of the crowd. As he surveyed the rest of the station, something unnerved him slightly. The earpiece crackled again. It was Howard Keegan, the director of Clock Tower, the counter-terrorism organization David worked for. Collector, appraiser, it seems the seller didn't like the market today. David was Jakarta Station chief, and Keegan was his boss and mentor. The older man clearly didn't want to step on David's toes by shutting down the operation, but the message was clear. Keegan had come all the way from London, hoping for a break. It was a big risk, given the other ongoing clock tower operation. I agree, David said. Let's shut it down. The two operatives casually vacated their positions and melted into the throngs of scurrying Indonesians. David took one last look at the newsstand. A tall man with a red windbreaker was paying for something. A newspaper. The New York Times. Stand by, trader and broker. We have a buyer looking at merchandise, David said. The man stepped back, held the paper up, and paused for a few seconds to read the front page. Without looking around, he folded the newspaper, tossed it in the trash can, and walked quickly toward the loaded train moving away from the station. Contact? I'm engaging. David's mind raced as he bounded from the shadow and into the crowd. Why was the man late? And his appearance, it was wrong. The overt red windbreaker. The posture, a soldier's posture, or an operative's. The way he walked. The man pushed onto the train and began snaking through the thick crowd of standing men and sitting women. The man was taller than almost everyone on the train, and David could still see his head. David squeezed onto the train and stopped. Why was the contact running? Had he seen something? Been spooked? And then it happened. The man turned, glancing back at David, and the look in his eyes said it all. David wheeled around and swept the four men standing in the doorway out onto the platform. He pushed them away from the train as more anxious commuters poured onto the train in the hole he had made. David was about to shout when the explosion tore through the train, spraying shards of glass and metal into the station. The blast threw David to the concrete floor of the platform, sandwiching him between bodies, some dead, others writhing in pain. Screams filled the air. Through the smoke, pieces of ash and debris drifted down like falling snow. David couldn't move his arms or legs. His head rolled back, and he almost lost consciousness. For a moment, he was back in New York, running away from the crumbling building. Then he was under it, trapped, waiting. Hands from unseen arms grabbed him and pulled him out. "We got you, buddy," they said. The sirens from trucks labeled FDNY and NYPD rang out as the sunlight hit his face. But it wasn't an ambulance this time. It was a black delivery van outside the train station. The men, not FDNY. The two operatives, trader and broker. They hoisted David into the van and sped away as Jakartan police and fire teams filled the streets. Chapter 3. Autism Research Center, ARC, Jakarta, Indonesia. Playroom 4 buzzed with activity. The scene was typical, toys strewn everywhere, with about a dozen children scattered throughout the room, each playing alone, focused intensely. In the corner, an 8-year-old child named Addie rocked back and forth as he built a puzzle with ease. When he placed the last block, he looked up at Ben, a proud smile on his face. Kate couldn't believe it. The boy had just assembled a puzzle her team used to identify savants, autistic individuals with special cognitive abilities. The puzzle required an IQ in the 140 to 180 range. Kate couldn't do it. And only one child in the study could, Satya. Kate watched as the child quickly built the puzzle, tore it down, and built it again. Then Addie stood up and took a seat on a bench beside Surya, a 7-year-old in the study. The smaller boy got up and completed the puzzle with just as much ease. Ben turned to Kate. Can you believe it? You think they're doing it from memory? From watching Satya? No. Or maybe. I doubt it, Kate said. Her mind raced. She needed time to think. She had to be sure. This is what you've been working on, isn't it? Ben said. Yes, Kate said, absently. It was impossible. It shouldn't have worked so quickly. Yesterday these children were classic cases of autism, if there was such a thing. Increasingly, researchers and physicians had begun recognizing autism as a spectrum of disorders with a wide range of symptoms. At the core of autism was a dysfunction in communication and social interaction. Most affected children avoided eye contact and socializing. Others wouldn't respond to their names. And in severe cases, children couldn't stand any contact. Yesterday, neither Addie nor Surya could have completed the puzzle, made eye contact, or much less taken turns. She had to tell Martin. He would make sure that their funding wasn't cut off. What do you want to do? Ben said. The excitement was clear in his voice. Take them to Observation 2. I need to make a call. Disbelief, exhaustion, and joy fought a battle in Kate's mind. And, we should administer a diagnostic? ADIR? No, ADOS 2. It will take less time. And let's film it. Kate smiled and gripped Ben's shoulder. She wanted to say something profound, something that would mark the moment. Words like she imagined brilliant and soon-to-be-famous scientists say at the breakthrough moment. But no words came, just a weary smile. Ben nodded and then took the children by the hands. Kate opened the door, and the four of them walked out into the corridor where two people were waiting. No, not people. Monsters. Dressed head to toe in black military gear. A helmet that covered a cloth mask. Dark, ski-like goggles, body armor, and black rubber gloves. Kate and Ben stopped, glanced at each other in disbelief, and corralled the children behind them. Kate cleared her throat and said, "This is a research lab. We don't have any cash here, but take the equipment, take whatever you want. We won't..." "Shut up!" The man's voice was rough, like someone who had spent a lifetime smoking and drinking. He turned to his smaller, black-clad accomplice, who was clearly a woman, and said, "Take them." The woman took a step toward the children. Without thinking, Kate moved into her path. "Don't. Take anything. Take me instead." The man took out a handgun and pointed it at her. "Step aside, Dr. Warner. I don't want to hurt you, but I will." He knew her name. Out of the corner of her eye, Kate saw Ben move closer, making for the gap between her and the monster with the gun. Addie tried to run, but the woman grabbed him by his shirt. Ben moved beside Kate, then in front of her, and they both rushed the man with the gun. They tackled him as the gun went off. Kate saw Ben roll off the black-clad man. Blood was everywhere. She tried to get up, but the man had her. He was too strong. He pinned her to the ground, and she heard a loud crack. Chapter 4. Clock Tower Safe House, Jakarta, Indonesia. 30 minutes after the train blast, David sat at a cheap, fold-out table in the safe house, enduring the medical tech's brutal treatment and trying to make sense of the attack. Ow! David winced and reeled back from the alcohol swab the tech had dabbed on his face. Thank you, really, but let's do this after. I'm fine. Flesh wounds. Across the room, Howard Keegan stood up from the bank of computer screens and walked over to David. It was a setup, David.
Why?
It makes no sense.
It does.
You need to see this. I received it right before the blast. Keegan handed him a sheet of paper. Eyes only. Clock Tower. CENTCOM. Clock Tower under attack. Cape Town and Mar del Plata stations destroyed. Karachi, Delhi, Dhaka, and Lahore breached. Recommend initiate firewall. Please advise. End bulletin. Keegan tucked the page back in his coat pocket. He lied about our security problem. David rubbed his temples. It was a nightmare scenario. His head was still throbbing from the bomb blast. He had to think. He didn't lie. Underestimated at the very least, or more likely a lie of omission to cripple and distract us from this larger attack on Clock Tower. The attack on Clock Tower doesn't mean the terrorist threat isn't real. It could be a prelude. Maybe. But the only thing we know is that Clock Tower's back is against the wall. Your first duty is to secure your station. You're the largest operation in Southeast Asia. Your HQ could be under attack right now. Keegan picked up his bag. I'm going back to London to try to manage things from there. Good luck, David. They shook, and David saw Keegan out of the safe house. On the street, a kid carrying a stack of newspapers ran up to David, waving them in the air and screaming, "Have you heard? Jakarta is under attack!" David pushed him away, but the kid shoved a rolled newspaper up into his hand and darted off around the corner. David started to toss the paper aside, but it was too heavy, and there was something wrapped inside. He unrolled the paper, and a round black pipe about a foot long fell out. A pipe bomb. Chapter 5. Autism Research Center, ARC, Jakarta, Indonesia. West Jakarta Police Chief Eddie Kuznadi mopped sweat from his brow as he walked into the crime scene, some science lab on the west end of town. A neighbor had reported a gunshot. It was a nicer neighborhood, the type where neighbors had political connections, so he had to check it out. The place was obviously some kind of medical facility, but some of the rooms looked almost like a daycare. Paku, one of his best plainclothes officers, waved him to a room in the back where he found an unconscious woman on the floor, a dead man in a pool of his own blood near her, and several cops standing around.
Lovers quarrel?
We don't think so, Paku said.
In the background, the chief could hear several kids crying. A native Indonesian woman entered the room, and upon seeing the bodies, instantly began screaming.
Get this lady out of here, the chief said.
Two officers corralled her out of the room. He said to Paku, the only remaining policeman,
Who are they?
The woman is Dr. Catherine Warner.
Doctor? This is a medical clinic?
No, a research facility. Warner is the head of it. The woman you just saw is one of the nannies for the children. They're doing research on retarded children.
Doesn't sound very profitable.
Who's the guy?
The chief said.
One of the lab technicians. The nanny says another technician offered to watch the kids, so she went home. The nanny says two kids are missing.
Runaways?
She thinks not, says the building has safeguards, Paku said.
Security cameras on the building?
No. Some observation cameras in the rooms with the kids. We're checking footage.
The chief bent down and looked the woman over. She was skinny, but not too skinny. He liked that. He felt for a pulse, then turned her head side to side to see if she had any head trauma. He noticed minor bruises on her wrists, but she seemed otherwise unharmed.
What a mess. Find out if she has any money. If so, bring her to the station. If not, dump her at the hospital.
Chapter 6 Imari Corp Research Complex, outside Burang, China, Tibet Autonomous Region. The project director strolled into Dr. Shen Cheng's office and tossed a file onto his desk.
We have a new therapy.
Dr. Cheng grabbed the file and began riffling through the pages. The director paced the length of the room.
It's very promising.
We're fast-tracking it. I want the machine ready and subjects treated with the new therapy within 4 hours. Cheng dropped the file and looked up. The scientist opened his mouth, but the director waved him off.
I don't want to hear it. The singularity could happen at any time. Today? Tomorrow? It could have already happened, for all we know. We don't have time for caution.
Cheng began to speak, but the director cut him off again.
And don't tell me you need more time. You've had time. We need results. Now tell me what it's going to take.
Cheng slumped in his chair.
The last test was a strain on the local power grid. We exceeded our capacity on site. We think we fixed the problem, but the regional power authority has to be suspicious about what we're doing. The bigger issue is that we're low on primates.
We're not testing it on primates. I want a human cohort of 50 ready to test. Cheng straightened himself and said with more force,
Setting the morality aside, which I urge you not to do, we would simply need a lot more data to begin a human trial. We would need...
You have it, Doctor. It's all in the file.
And we're retrieving more data now. That's not all. We have two subjects with sustained Atlantis gene activation.
Cheng's eyes widened.
You too?
How? The man pointed to the file in a quick, cobra-like motion.
The file, Doctor. It's all there. And they'll be here soon. You'd better be ready. All you have to do is replicate the gene therapy.
Cheng was flipping through the pages, reading and murmuring to himself.
He looked up. The subjects are children?
Yes. Is that a problem?
No. Well, maybe, or maybe not.
Maybe not is the right answer. Call me if you need me, Doctor.
4 hours. I don't have to tell you what's at stake.
But Dr. Cheng couldn't hear him. He was lost in the notes of Dr. Catherine Warner. Chapter 7 Clock Tower Station HQ, Jakarta, Indonesia. David peered at the black pipe through the narrow window of the blast shield. Turning the cap on the pipe had taken forever with the manually operated arm, but he had to look inside. It was the weight. The pipe was too light to be a bomb. Nails, buckshot, and BBs would weigh a lot more. Finally, the end fell off, and David tipped the pipe to one side. A rolled-up paper slid out. A thick, glossy page. A photo. David unrolled it. It was a satellite image of an iceberg floating in a deep blue sea. In the center of the iceberg, there was an oblong black object, a submarine sticking out of the ice. On the back, a message read, TOBA protocol is real. 4 plus 12 plus 47 equals 4 over 5. Jones. 7 plus 22 plus 47 equals 3 over 8. Anderson. 10 plus 4 plus 47 equals 5 over 4, Ames. David slipped the photo into a thick manila folder and walked over to the surveillance room. One of the two techs turned from the bank of screens.
No sign of him yet.
Anything from the airports? David asked. The man worked the keyboard, then looked up.
Yes, he landed a few minutes ago at Sukarno, Hatta.
You want us to have him detained there?
No. I need him here.
Just make sure they can't see him on surveillance upstairs. I'll take it from there. Chapter 8 BBC World Report, wire release. Potential terror attacks in residential neighborhoods in Mar del Plata, Argentina, and Cape Town, South Africa. Breaking news update. Additional blasts reported in Karachi, Pakistan, and Jakarta, Indonesia. We will update this report as details emerge. Cape Town, South Africa. The sound of automatic gunfire and grenade explosions shattered the early morning calm in Cape Town today, as a group estimated at 20 armed assailants entered an apartment building and killed 14 people. Police have released no official information about the attack. Eyewitnesses at the scene described it as a special operation-style attack. A BBC reporter on site took this eyewitness statement.
Yeah, I seen it. Looked like a tank or something, you know. One of them armored troop carriers, rolling up on the curb and then dudes was pouring it out like ninjas or robot soldiers or something, moving all mechanical-like. And then it's like the whole building exploded, glass falling all over the place. And I ran up on out of there. I mean, it's a rough neighborhood, but man, I ain't never seen nothing like that. I figured at first it was, you know, a drug raid. Whatever it was, it done gone real wrong.
Another witness, also speaking on the condition of anonymity, confirmed that the group had no official insignia on their vehicle or uniforms. A reporter with Reuters, who briefly gained access to the scene before police removed him, described it this way. It looked to me like a safe house, maybe CIA or MI6. It would have to be somebody very well funded to have that kind of technology. A situation room with wall-to-wall computer screens and a massive server room. There were bodies everywhere. About half wore plain clothes. The rest were dressed in black body armor, similar to what witnesses say the attackers wore. It remains unclear if the attackers incurred any casualties and were forced to leave anyone behind, or if the bodies were those of individuals defending the location. The BBC sought a comment from both the CIA and MI6 for this report. Both declined. It's unknown whether this incident is in any way related to a similar incident earlier today in Mar del Plata, Argentina, where a massive explosion in a low-income neighborhood killed 12 people at approximately 2 a.m. local time. Bystanders say the explosion followed a raid by a heavily armed group that no one could identify. As with the attack in Cape Town, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack in Mar del Plata.
It's very concerning that we have no idea who is involved, said Richard Buchmeier, a professor at American University. Based on the initial reports, if either the victims or the perpetrators of the attacks are part of a terrorist network, it would indicate a level of sophistication not currently thought possible by any known terror entity. It's either a new actor or a significant evolution of an existing group. Both scenarios would require re-examining what we think we know about the global terrorism landscape. We will update this story as details unfold.
Chapter 9. David was studying a map of Jakarta and Clock Tower's safe houses around the city when the surveillance tech walked in.
He's here. David folded the map up.
Good.
Josh Cohen walked toward the nondescript apartment building that housed Clock Tower's Jakarta Station headquarters. The buildings around it were mostly abandoned, a mix of failed housing projects and dilapidated warehouses. The sign on the building read, Clock Tower Security, Inc., and to the outside world, Clock Tower Security was just one of a growing number of private security firms. Officially, Clock Tower Security offered personal protection and bodyguard services to corporate executives and high-value foreign nationals visiting Jakarta, as well as private investigation services when local law enforcement was less than cooperative. It was the perfect cover. Josh entered the building, walked down a long hallway, opened a heavy steel door, and approached the shiny silver elevator doors. A panel beside the doors slid back, and he placed his hand on the reflective surface and said, "Josh Cohen, verify my voice." A second panel opened, this one level with his face, and a red beam scanned up and down while he held his eyes open and head still. The elevator dinged, opened, and began carrying Josh to the building's middle floor. The elevator ascended silently, but Josh knew that elsewhere in the building, a surveillance tech was reviewing a full body scan of him, verifying he had no bugs, bombs, or otherwise problematic items. If he was carrying anything, the elevator would fill with a colorless, odorless gas, and he'd wake up in a holding cell. It would be the last room he'd ever see. If he passed, the elevator would take him to the fourth floor, his home for the last 3 years, and the Jakarta headquarters of Clock Tower. Clock Tower was the world's secret answer to stateless terror, a stateless counterterrorism agency. No red tape, no bureaucracy, just good guys killing bad guys. It wasn't quite that simple, but Clock Tower was as close as the world would ever get. Clock Tower was independent, apolitical, anti-dogmatic, and most importantly, extremely effective. And for those reasons, the intelligence services of nations around the world supported Clock Tower, despite knowing almost nothing about it. No one knew when it had started, who directed it, how it was funded, or where it was headquartered. When Josh had joined Clock Tower 3 years ago, he had assumed he would get answers to those questions as a Clock Tower insider. He had been wrong. He had risen through the ranks quickly, becoming chief of intelligence analysis for Jakarta Station, but he still knew no more about Clock Tower than the day he'd been recruited from the CIA's Office of Terrorism Analysis. And they seemed to want it that way. Within Clock Tower, information was strictly compartmentalized among the independent cells. Everyone shared intel with Central. Everyone got intel from Central, but no cell had the big picture, or insight into the larger operation. And for that reason, Josh had been shocked to receive an invitation 6 days ago to a sort of summit meeting for the chief analysts of every Clock Tower cell. He had confronted David Vale, the Jakarta station director, asking him if this was a joke. He'd said that it wasn't, and that all the directors had been made aware of the meeting. Josh's shock at the invitation was quickly trumped by the revelations at the conference. The first surprise was the number of attendees, 238. Josh had assumed Clock Tower was relatively small, with maybe 50 or so cells in the world's hotspots. But instead, the entire globe was represented. Assuming each cell was the size of Jakarta Station, about 50 agents, there could be over 10,000 people working in the cells, plus the central organization, which had to be at least 1,000 people just to correlate and analyze the intel, not to mention coordinate the cells. The organization's scale was shocking. It could be almost the size of the CIA, which had had around 20,000 total employees when Josh had worked there. And many of those 20,000 worked in analysis in Langley, Virginia, not in the field. Clock Tower was lean. It had none of the CIA's bureaucracies and organizational fat. Clock Tower's special ops capabilities likely dwarfed that of any government on Earth. Each Clock Tower cell had three groups. One-third of the staff were case officers, similar to the CIA's National Clandestine Service. They worked undercover in actual terror organizations, cartels, and other bad guy-run groups, or in places where they could develop sources, local governments, banks, and police departments. Their goal was human intelligence. Humint. First-hand intel. Another third of each cell worked as analysts. The analysts spent the vast majority of their time on two activities, hacking and guessing. They hacked everyone and everything, phone calls, emails, texts. They combined that signal's intelligence, or SIGINT, with HUMINT and any other local intel and transmitted it to Central. Josh's chief responsibilities were to make sure Jakarta Station maximized its intelligence gathering and to draw conclusions about the intel. Drawing conclusions sounded better than guessing, but his job essentially came down to guessing and making recommendations to the station chief. The station chief, with counsel from Central, then authorized local operations, which were conducted by the cell's covert operations group, the last third of the staff. Jakarta's covert ops group had developed a reputation as one of Clock Tower's leading strike teams. That status had afforded Josh something of a celebrity status at the conference. Josh's cell was the de facto leader of the Asia-Pacific region, and everyone wanted to know what their tricks of the trade were. But not everyone was starstruck with Josh. He was glad to see many of his old friends at the conference, people he had worked with at the CIA or liaised with from other governments. It was incredible. He had been communicating with people he had known for years. Clock Tower had a strict policy. Every new member got a new name. Your past was destroyed, and you couldn't reveal your identity outside the cell. Outbound phone calls were voice-altered by computer. In-person contact was strictly forbidden. A face-to-face meeting with every chief analyst of every cell shattered that veil of secrecy. It went against every Clock Tower operating protocol. Josh knew there must be a reason, something extremely compelling and extremely urgent to take the risk. But he never would have guessed the secret Central revealed at the conference. He still couldn't believe it. And he had to tell David Vale immediately. Josh walked to the front of the elevator and stood close to the doors, ready to make a beeline for the station chief's office. It was 9 a.m. and Jakarta Station would be in full swing. The analysts' pit would be lit up like the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, with analysts crowded around banks of monitors pointing and arguing. Across the floor, the door to the field ops prep room would be wide open and likely full of operatives getting ready for the day. The late arrivals would be standing in front of their lockers, donning their body armor quickly and stuffing extra magazines in every pocket on their person. The early risers usually sat around on the wood benches and talked about sports and weapons before the morning briefings, their camaraderie interrupted only by the occasional locker room prank. It was home, and Josh had to admit that he had missed it, although the conference was rewarding in ways he hadn't anticipated. Knowing he was part of a larger community of chief analysts, people who shared the same life experiences as him, people who had the same problems and fears as he did, was surprisingly comforting. In Jakarta, he was head of analysis. He had a team that worked for him, and he answered only to the station chief. But he had no real peers, no one to really talk to. Intelligence work was a lonely profession, especially for the people in charge. It had certainly taken its toll on some of his old friends. Many had aged well beyond their years. Others had become hardened and distant. After seeing them, Josh had wondered if he would end up that way. Everything had a price, but he believed in the work they were doing. No job was perfect. As his thoughts drifted back from the conference, he realized the elevator should have opened by now. When he turned his head to look around, the elevator lights blurred, like a video in slow motion. His body felt heavy. He could hardly breathe. He reached out to grab the elevator rail, but his hand wouldn't close. It slipped off, and the steel floor rushed up. Chapter 10. Interrogation Room C, West Jakarta Police Detention Center, Jakarta, Indonesia. Kate's head was killing her. Her body ached, and the police had been no help at all. She had woken up in the back of a police car, and the driver had refused to tell her anything. Things had only gotten worse once she reached the police station. "Why won't you listen to me? Why the hell aren't you out looking for those two boys?" Kate Warner stood, leaned over the metal table and stared at the smug little interrogator who had already wasted 20 minutes of her time. "We are trying to find them. That is why we are asking you these questions, Miss Warner."
I already told you I don't know anything.
Maybe, maybe not.